happen? To you. Charisse meets my eyes. I feel ill. Excuse me, I say to her. I get up and make my way to the tiny Marilyn Monroe plastered bathroom. I splash my face with cold water. I lean against the wall with my eyes closed. When it becomes obvious that I'm not going anywhere, I walk back into the cafe and sit down. Sorry. You were saying? Charisse looks scared and small. Henry, she says quietly. Tell me. Tell you what, Charisse? Tell me you aren't going anywhere. Tell me Claire doesn't want Gomez. Tell me everything's gonna work out, or tell me it's all shit. I don't know, just tell me what happens. Her voice shakes. She puts her hand on my arm, and I force myself not to pull away. You'll be fine, Charisse. It'll be okay. She stares at me, not believing, and wanting to believe. I lean back in my chair. He won't leave you. She sighs.
And you?
I am silent. Charisse stares at me, and then she bows her head.
Let's go home,
she says, finally. And we do.
Sunday, June 12, 2005. Claire is 34. Henry is 41. It's a sunny Sunday afternoon, and I walk into the kitchen to find Henry standing by the window staring out at the backyard. He beckons me over. I stand beside him and look out. Alba is playing in the yard with an older girl. The girl's about 7. She has long dark hair and she is barefoot. She wears a dirty t-shirt with the Cubs logo on it. They are both sitting on the ground facing each other. The girl has her back to us. Alba is smiling at her and gesturing with her hands as though she is flying. The girl shakes her head and laughs. I look at Henry. Who is that?
That's Alba.
Yes, but who's with her? Henry smiles, but his eyebrows pull together so that the smile seems worried.
Claire, that's Alba, when she's older. She's time traveling.
My God! I stare at the girl. She swivels and points at the house, and I see a quick profile, and then she turns away again. Should we go out there?
No, she's fine. If they want to come in here, they will.
I'd love to meet her.
Better not, Henry begins. But as he speaks, the two Albas jump up and come racing toward the back door, hand in hand. They burst into the kitchen, laughing.
Mama! Mama! Says my Alba, 3-year-old Alba, pointing. Look, a big girl Alba!
The other Alba grins and says, Hi, Mama! And I am smiling and I say, Hello, Alba! When she turns and sees Henry and cries out, Daddy! And runs to him, throws her arms around him, and starts to cry. Henry glances at me, bends over Alba, rocking her, and whispers something in her ear.
Claire is white-faced. She stands watching us, holding small Alba's hand. Alba, who stands watching open-mouthed as her older self, clings to me, weeping. I lean down to Alba, whisper in her ear. Don't tell Mama I died, okay? She looks up at me, tears clinging to her long lashes, lips quivering, and nods. Claire is holding a tissue, telling Alba to blow her nose, hugging her. Alba allows herself to be led off to wash her face. Small Alba, present Alba, wraps herself around my leg.
Why, Daddy? Why is she sad?
Fortunately, I don't have to answer because Claire and Alba have returned. Alba is wearing one of Claire's t-shirts and a pair of my cutoffs. Claire says, Hey, everybody, why don't we go get an ice cream? Both Albas smile. Small Alba dances around us, yelling, Ice cream! You scream! Ice cream! You scream! We pile into the car, Claire driving, 3-year-old Alba in the front seat, and 7-year-old Alba in the back seat with me. She leans against me. I put my arm around her. Nobody says a word except little Alba, who says,
"Look, Alba, doggy! Look, Alba, look, Alba!"
Until her older self says, "Yeah, Alba, I see." Claire drives us to Zephyr. We settle into a blue glitter vinyl booth and order 2 banana splits, a chocolate malt, and a soft-serve vanilla cone with sprinkles. The girls suck down their banana splits like vacuum cleaners. Claire and I toy with our ice cream, not looking at each other. Claire says, "Alba, what's going on in your present?" Alba darts a look at me. "Not much," she says. "Gramps is teaching me Saint-Saëns' second violin concerto." "You're in a play at school," I prompt.
"I am?"
she says.
"Well, not yet, I guess."
"Oh, sorry," I say. "I guess that's not till next year." It goes on like this. We make halting conversation, working around what we know, what we must protect Claire and small Alba from knowing. After a while, older Alba puts her head and her hands on the table. "Tired?" Claire asks her. She nods. "We better go," I tell Claire. We pay, and I pick Alba up. She's limp, almost asleep in my arms. Claire scoops up little Alba, who's hyper from all the sugar. Back in the car as we're cruising up Lincoln Avenue, Alba vanishes. "She's gone back," I say to Claire. She holds my eyes in the rearview mirror for a few moments.
"Back where, Daddy?" asks Alba. "Back where?"
Later. I finally managed to get Alba to take a nap. Henry is sitting on our bed drinking scotch and staring out the window at some squirrels chasing each other around the grape arbor. I walk over and sit down next to him. "Hey," I say. Henry looks at me, puts his arm around me, pulls me to him. "Hey," he says. "Are you going to tell me what that was all about?" I ask him. Henry puts down his drink and starts to undo the buttons on my shirt. "Can I get away with not telling you?" "No." I unbuckle his belt and open the button of his jeans. "Are you sure?" He's kissing my neck. "Yes." I slide his zipper down, run my hand under his shirt, over his stomach.
"Because you don't really want to know."
Henry breathes into my ear and runs his tongue around the rim. I shiver. He takes off my shirt, undoes the clasp of my bra. My breasts fall loose and I lie back, watching Henry stripping off his jeans and underwear and shirt. He climbs onto the bed and I say, "Socks."
"Oh yeah."
He takes off his socks. We look at each other. "You're just trying to distract me," I say. Henry caresses my stomach.
"I'm trying to distract myself. If I also manage to distract you, that's a bonus."
"You have to tell me."
"No, I don't."
He cups my breasts in his hands, runs his thumbs over my nipples. "I'll imagine the worst."
"Go ahead."
I raise my hips and Henry pulls off my jeans and my underwear. He straddles me, leans over me, kisses me. "Oh, God," I think. "What can it be? What is the worst?" I close my eyes. A memory. The meadow. A cold day in my childhood, running over dead grass, there was a noise. He called my name.
"Claire."
Henry is biting my lips gently.
"Where are you?"
1984. Henry pauses and says,
"Why?"
"I think that's where it happens."
"Where what happens?"
"Whatever it is you're afraid to tell me." Henry rolls off of me and we are lying side by side.
"Tell me about it," he says.
"It was early. A day in the fall. Daddy and Mark were out deer hunting. I woke up. I thought I heard you calling me. And I ran out into the meadow and you were there. And you and Daddy and Mark were all looking at something. But Daddy made me go back to the house so I never saw what you were looking at."
"Oh?"
"I went back there later in the day. There was a place in the grass all soaked in blood." Henry says nothing. He presses his lips together. I wrap my arms around him, hold him tightly. I say, "The worst,
Hush, Claire.
But...
Shh. Outside, it is still a golden afternoon. Inside, we are cold, and we cling together for warmth. Alba, in her bed, sleeps and dreams of ice cream, dreams the small, contented dreams of three, while another Alba, somewhere in the future, dreams of wrapping her arms around her father, and wakes up to find... what?
The episode of the Monroe Street parking garage. Monday, January 7th, 2006. Claire is 34. Henry is 42. We are sleeping, deep, early morning, winter sleep, when the phone rings. I snap into wakefulness, my heart surging, and realize Henry is there beside me. He reaches over me and picks up the phone. I glance at the clock. It's 4:32 a.m.
"Hello?" says Henry.
He listens for a long minute. I am wide awake now. Henry is expressionless.
"Okay, stay there. We'll leave right now."
He leans over and replaces the receiver. "Who was it?"
"Me. It was me. I'm down in the Monroe Street parking garage, no clothes, 15 degrees below zero. God, I hope the car starts."
We jump out of bed and throw on yesterday's clothes. Henry is booted and has his coat on before I'm in my jeans, and he runs out to start the car. I stuff Henry's shirt and long underwear and jeans and socks and boots and extra coat and mittens and a blanket into a shopping bag, wake Alba and stuff her into her coat and boots, fly into my coat and out the door. I pull out of the garage before the car is warmed up and it dies. I restart it. We sit for a minute and I try again. It snowed 6 inches yesterday, and Ainsley is rutted with ice. Alba is whining in her car seat, and Henry shushes her. When we get to Lawrence, I speed up, and in 10 minutes we are on the drive. There's no one out at this hour. The Honda's heater purrs. Over the lake, the sky is becoming lighter. Everything is blue and orange, brittle in the extreme cold. As we sail down Lakeshore Drive, I have a strong déjà vu. The cold, the lake in dreamy silence, the sodium glow of the streetlights. I've been here before. Been here before. I'm deeply enmeshed in this moment, and it stretches on, carrying me away from the strangeness of the thing into awareness of the duplicity of now. Although we are speeding through this winter cityscape, time stands immobile. We pass Irving, Belmont, Fullerton, LaSalle. I exit at Michigan. We fly down the deserted corridor of expensive shops, Oak Street, Chicago, Randolph, Monroe, and now we are diving down into the subterranean concrete world of the parking garage. I take the ticket the ghostly female machine voice offers me.
"Drive to the northwest end," says Henry. "The payphone by the security station."
I follow his instructions. The déjà vu is gone. I feel as though I've been abandoned by a protective angel. The garage is virtually empty. I speed across acres of yellow lines to the payphone. The receiver dangles from its cord. No Henry.
"Maybe you got back to the present?" "But maybe not."
Henry is confused, and so am I. We get out of the car. It's cold down here. My breath condenses and vanishes. I don't feel as though we should leave, but I don't have any idea what might have happened. I walk over to the security station and peer in the window. No guard. The video monitors show empty concrete.
Shit, where would I go? Let's drive around.
We get back into the car and cruise slowly through the vast, pillared chambers of vacant space, past signs directing us to go slow, more parking, remember your car's location. No Henry anywhere. We look at each other in defeat.
When were you coming from?
I didn't say.
We drive home in silence. Alba is sleeping. Henry stares out the window. The sky is cloudless and pink in the east, and there are more cars out now, early commuters. As we wait for the stoplight at Ohio Street, I hear seagulls squawking. The streets are dark with salt and water. The city is soft, white, obscured by snow. Everything is beautiful. I am detached. I am a movie. We are seemingly unscathed.
But sooner or later, there will be hell to pay.
Birthday. Thursday, June 15, 2006. Claire is 35. Tomorrow is Henry's birthday. I'm in vintage vinyl trying to find an album he will love that he doesn't already have. I was kind of counting on asking Vaughn, the owner of the shop, for help, because Henry's been coming here for years. But there's a high school kid behind the counter. He's wearing a Seven Dead Arson t-shirt, and probably wasn't even born when most of the stuff in the shop was being recorded. I flip through the bins. Sex Pistols, Patti Smith, Supertramp, Matthew Sweet, Fish, Pixies, Pogues, Pretenders, B-52s, Kate Bush, Buzzcocks, Echo and the Bunnymen, The Art of Noise, The Nails, The Clash, The Cramps, The Cure, Television. I pause over an obscure Velvet Underground retread, trying to remember if I've seen it lying around the house. But on closer scrutiny, I realize it's just a mishmash of stuff Henry has on other albums. Dazzling Killmen, Dead Kennedys. Vaughn comes in carrying a huge box, heaves it behind the counter, and goes back out. He does this a few more times, and then he and the kids start to unpack the boxes, piling LPs onto the counter, exclaiming over various things I've never heard of. I walk over to Vaughn and mutely fan three LPs before him. "Hi, Claire," he says, grinning hugely. "How's it going?" "Hi, Vaughn. Tomorrow's Henry's birthday. Help." He eyeballs my selections. "He's already got those two," he says, nodding at Lilliput and the Breeders. "And that's really awful," indicating the Plasmatics. "Great cover, though, huh?"
"Yeah. Do you have anything in that box he might like?"
"Nah, this is all 50s. Some old lady died. You might like this. I just got this yesterday."
He pulls a Golden Palominos compilation out of the new arrivals bin. There's a couple new things on it, so I take it. Suddenly, Vaughn grins at me.
"I've got something really oddball for you. I've been saving it for Henry."
He steps behind the counter and fishes around in the depths for a minute.
"Here."
Vaughn hands me an LP in a blank white jacket. I slide the record out and read the label. Annette Lynn Robinson. Paris Opera, May 13, 1968. Lulu. I look at Vaughn questioningly.
"Yeah, not his usual thing, huh? It's a bootleg of a concert. It doesn't officially exist. He asked me to keep an eye out for her stuff a while back, but it's not my usual thing either, so I found it, and then I kept forgetting to tell him. I listened to it. It's really nice. Good sound quality."
"Thank you," I whisper.
"You're welcome. Hey, what's the big deal?"
"She's Henry's mother." Vaughn raises his eyebrows, and his forehead scrunches up comically. "No kidding."
"Yeah, he looks like her."
"Huh, that's interesting. You'd think he would have mentioned it." "He doesn't talk about her much. She died when he was little, in a car accident."
"Oh, that's right, I sort of remember that. Well, can I find anything else for you?"
"No, that's it." I pay Vaughn and leave, hugging the voice of Henry's mother to me as I walk down Davis Street in an ecstasy of anticipation.
Friday, June 16th, 2006. Henry is 43, Claire is 35. It's my 43rd birthday. My eyes pop open at 6:46 a.m., even though I have the day off from work, and I can't get back to sleep. I look over at Claire, and she's utterly abandoned to slumber. Arms cast apart, and hair fanned over her pillow willy-nilly. She looks beautiful, even with creases from the pillowcase across her cheeks. I get out of bed carefully, go to the kitchen, and start the coffee. In the bathroom, I run the water for a while, waiting for it to get hot. We should get a plumber in here, but we never get around to it. Back in the kitchen, I pour a cup of coffee, carry it to the bathroom, and balance it on the sink. I lather my face and start to shave. Ordinarily, I'm an expert at shaving without actually looking at myself, but today, in honor of my birthday, I take inventory. My hair has gone almost white, There's a bit of black left at the temples, and my eyebrows are still completely black. I've grown it out some, not as long as I used to wear it before I met Claire, but not short either. My skin is wind-roughened, and there are creases at the edges of my eyes and across my forehead and lines that run from my nostrils to the corners of my mouth. My face is too thin. All of me is too thin. Not Auschwitz thin, but not normal thin either. Early stages of cancer thin, perhaps. Heroin addict thin. I don't want to think about it, so I continue shaving. I rinse off my face, apply aftershave, step back, and survey the results. At the library yesterday, someone remembered that it's my birthday, and so Roberto, Isabel, Matt, Catherine, and Amelia gathered me up and took me to Bow Tie for lunch. I know there's been some talk at work about my health, about why I've suddenly lost so much weight and the fact that I've recently aged rapidly. Everyone was extra nice, the way people are to AIDS victims and chemotherapy patients. I almost long for someone to just ask me so I can lie to them and get it over with. But instead we joked around and ate pad thai and prick king, cashew chicken and pad siu. Amelia gave me a pound of killer Colombian coffee beans. Catherine, Matt, Roberto, and Isabel splurged and got me the Getty facsimile of the Mira Calligraphii Monumenta, which I'd been lusting after in the Newbery bookstore for ages. I looked up at them, heartstruck, and I realized that my co-workers think I am dying. "You guys," I said, and I couldn't think how to go on, so I didn't. It's not often that words fail me. Claire gets up, Alba wakes up, we all get dressed and pack the car. We're going to Brookfield Zoo with Gomez and Charisse and their kids. We spend the day ambling around, looking at monkeys and flamingos, polar bears and otters. Alba likes the big cats best. Rosa holds Alba's hand and tells her about dinosaurs. Gomez does a great impression of a chimp, and Max and Joe rampage around pretending to be elephants and playing handheld video games. Charisse and Claire and I stroll aimlessly, talking about nothing, soaking in the sunlight. At 4 o'clock, the kids are all tired and cranky, and we pack them back in the cars, promise to do it again soon, and go home. The babysitter arrives promptly at 7. Claire bribes and threatens Alba to be good, and we escape. We are dressed in the nines, at Claire's insistence, and as we sail south on Lakeshore Drive, I realize that I don't know where we're going. "You'll see," says Claire. "It's not a surprise party, is it?" I ask apprehensively. "No," she assures me. Claire exits the drive at Roosevelt and threads her way through Pilsen, a Hispanic neighborhood just south of downtown. Groups of kids are playing in the streets, and we weave around them and finally park near 20th and Racine. Claire leads me to a run-down two-flat and rings the bell at the gate. We're buzzed in, and we make our way through the trash-littered yard and up precarious stairs. Claire knocks on one of the doors, and it is opened by Lourdes, a friend of Claire's from art school. Lourdes smiles and beckons us inside. And as we step in, I see that the apartment has been transformed into a restaurant with only one table. Beautiful smells are wafting around, and the table is laid with white damask, china, candles. A record player stands on a heavy carved sideboard. In the living room are cages full of birds, parrots, canaries, tiny lovebirds. Lourdes kisses my cheek and says, "Happy birthday, Henry." And a familiar voice says, "Yeah, happy birthday." I stick my head into the kitchen, and there's Nell. She's stirring something in a saucepan, and she doesn't stop even when I wrap my arms around her and lift her slightly off the ground. "Ooh-wee," she says, "you've been eating your Wheaties." Claire hugs Nell, and they smile at each other. "He looks pretty surprised," Nell says, and Claire just smiles even more broadly. "Go on and sit down," Nell commands. "Dinner is ready." We sit facing each other at the table. Lourdes brings small plates of exquisitely arranged antipasti. Transparent prosciutto with pale yellow melon. Mussels that are mild and smoky. Slender strips of carrot and beet that taste of fennel and olive oil. In the candlelight, Claire's skin is warm and her eyes are shadowed. The pearls she's wearing delineate her collarbones and the pale, smooth area above her breasts. They rise and fall with her breath. Claire catches me staring at her and smiles and looks away. I look down and realize that I've finished eating my mussels and I'm sitting there holding a tiny fork in the air like an idiot. I put it down and Lourdes removes our plates and brings the next course. We eat Nell's beautiful rare tuna, braised with a sauce of tomatoes, apples, and basil. We eat small salads full of radicchio and orange peppers, and we eat little brown olives that remind me of a meal I ate with my mother in a hotel in Athens when I was very young. We drink Sauvignon Blanc, toasting each other repeatedly. To olives! To babysitters! To Nell! Nell emerges from the kitchen carrying a small flat white cake that blazes with candles. Claire, Nell, and Lourdes sing happy birthday to me. I make a wish and blow out the candles in one breath. That means you get your wish, says Nell, but mine is not a wish that can be granted. The birds talk to each other in strange voices as we all eat cake, and then Lourdes and Nell vanish back into the kitchen. Claire says, I got you a present. Close your eyes. I close my eyes. I hear Claire push her chair back from the table. She walks across the room. Then there is the noise of a needle hitting vinyl, a hiss, violins, a pure soprano piercing like sharp rain through the clamor of the orchestra. My mother's voice, singing Lulu. I open my eyes. Claire sits across the table from me, smiling. I stand up and pull her from her chair, embrace her.
Amazing,
I say. And then I can't continue, so I kiss her. Much later, after we have said goodbye to Nell and Lourdes with many teary expressions of gratitude, after we have made our way home and paid the babysitter, after we have made love in a daze of exhausted pleasure, we lie in bed on the verge of sleep, and Claire says,
Was it a good birthday?
Perfect, I say.
The best. Do you ever wish you could stop time?
Claire asks.
I wouldn't mind staying here forever.
I say, rolling onto my stomach. As I slide into sleep, Claire says,
I feel like we're at the top of a roller coaster.
But then I am asleep. And I forget to ask her in the morning what she means. An unpleasant scene. Wednesday, June 28th, 2006. Henry is 43 and 43. I come to in the dark on a cold concrete floor. I try to sit up, but I get dizzy and I lie down again. My head is aching. I explore with my hands. There's a big, swollen area just behind my left ear. As my eyes adjust, I see the faint outlines of stairs and exit signs, and far above me a lone, fluorescent bulb emitting cold light. All around me is the crisscross steel pattern of the cage. I'm at the Newberry after hours, inside the cage. Don't panic, I say to myself out loud. It's okay, it's okay, it's okay. I stop when I realize that I'm not listening to myself. I manage to get to my feet. I'm shivering. I wonder how long I have to wait. I wonder what my co-workers will say when they see me, because this is it. I'm about to be revealed as the tenuous freak of nature that I really am. I have not been looking forward to this, to say the least. I try pacing back and forth to keep warm, but this makes my head throb. I give it up, sit down in the middle of the floor of the cage, and make myself as compact as possible. Hours go by. I replay this whole incident in my head, rehearsing my lines, considering all the ways it could have gone better or worse. Finally, I get tired of that and play records for myself in my head. That's Entertainment by The Jam, Pills and Soap by Elvis Costello, Perfect Day by Lou Reed. I'm trying to remember all the words to the Gang of Four's I Love a Man in a Uniform when the lights blink on. Of course, it's Kevin, the security Nazi, opening the library. Kevin is the last person on the entire planet I would want to encounter while naked and trapped in the cage, so naturally he spots me as soon as he walks in. I'm curled up on the floor playing possum. "Who's there?" Kevin says, louder than necessary. I imagine Kevin standing there, pasty and hungover in the dank light of the stairwell. His voice bounces around, echoing off the concrete. Kevin walks down the stairs and stands at the bottom, about 10 feet away from me. "How'd you get in there?" He walks around the cage. I continue to pretend to be unconscious. Since I can't explain, I might as well not be bothered. "My God, it's the Temple!" I can feel him standing there, gaping. Finally, he remembers his radio. 10-4. Hey, Roy." Unintelligible static. Yeah, Roy, it's Kevin. Could you come on down to A46? Yeah, at the bottom." Squawks. "Just come on down here." He turns the radio off. "Lord, Tambo, I don't know what you think you're trying to prove, but you sure have done it now." I hear him moving around. His shoes squeak and he makes a soft grunting noise. I imagine he must be sitting on the stairs. After a few minutes, a door opens upstairs and Roy comes down. Roy is my favorite security guy. He's a huge African-American gentleman who always has a beautiful smile on his face. He's the king of the main desk, and I'm always glad to arrive at work and bask in his magnificent good cheer. "Whoa," Roy says. "What have we here?" "It's the Tamble. I can't figure out how he got in there." "The Tamble? My, my. That boy sure has a thing for airing out his Johnson. I ever tell you about the time I found him running around the third floor link in his altogether?" "Yeah, you did." "Well, I guess we gotta get him out of there." "He's not moving." "Well, he's breathing. You think he's hurt? Maybe we should call an ambulance." "We're gonna need the fire department. Cut him out with those jaws of life things they use on the wrecks." Kevin sounds excited. "I don't want the fire department or paramedics." I groan and sit up. "Good morning, Mr. DeTamble," Roy croons. "You're here a bit early, aren't you?" "Just a bit," I agree, pulling my knees to my chin. I'm so cold my teeth hurt from being clenched. I contemplate Kevin and Roy, and they return my gaze. "I don't suppose I could bribe you gentlemen?" They exchange glances. "Depends," Kevin says, "on what you have in mind. We can't keep our mouths shut about this because we can't get you out by ourselves." No, I wouldn't expect that." They look relieved. "Listen, I will give each of you $100 if you will do two things for me. The first thing is, I would like one of you to go out and get me a cup of coffee." Roy's face breaks into his patented king of the main desk smile. "Hell, Mr. DeTamble, I'll do that for free. Course, I don't know how you're gonna drink it." "Bring a straw, and don't get it from the machines in the lounge. Go out and get real coffee. Cream, no sugar." "Will do," says Roy. What's the second thing? Asked Kevin. I want you to go up to Special Collections and grab some clothes out of my desk, lower right-hand drawer. Bonus points if you can do it without anyone noticing what you're up to. No sweat, Kevin says, and I wonder why I ever disliked the man. Better lock off this stairwell, Roy says to Kevin, who nods and walks off to do it. Roy stands at the side of the cage and looks at me with pity. So, how'd you get yourself in there? I shrug. I don't have a really good answer for that. Roy smiles, shakes his head. Well, think about it, and I'll go get you that cup of coffee. About 20 minutes pass. Finally, I hear a door being unlocked, and Kevin comes down the stairs, followed by Matt and Roberto. Kevin catches my eye and shrugs as though to say, I tried. He feeds my shirt through the mesh of the cage, and I put it on while Roberto stands regarding me coldly with his arms crossed. The pants are a little bulky, and it takes some effort to get them into the cage. Matt is sitting on the stairs with a doubtful expression. I hear the door opening again. It's Roy bringing coffee and a sweet roll. He places a straw in my coffee and sets it on the floor next to the roll. I have to drag my eyes away from it to look at Roberto, who turns to Roy and Kevin and asks, May we have some privacy?
Certainly, Dr. Kelly.
The security guards walk upstairs and out the first floor door. Now I am alone, trapped, and bereft of an explanation before Roberto, whom I revere and whom I have lied to repeatedly. Now there is only the truth, which is more outrageous than any of my lies.
All right, Henry, says Roberto. Let's have it.
It's a perfect September morning. I'm a little late to work because of Alba. She refused to get dressed. And the L, it refused to come, but not terribly late. By my standards, anyway. When I sign in at the main desk, there's no Roy. It's Marcia. I say, Hey, Marcia, where's Roy? And she says, Oh, he's attending to some business. I say, Oh, and take the elevator to the fourth floor. When I walk into Special Collections, Isabel says, You're late. And I say, But not very. I walk into my office, and Matt is standing at my window, looking out over the park. Hi, Matt, I say, and Matt jumps a mile.
Henry, he says, going white, how did you get out of the cage?
I set my knapsack on my desk and stare at him. The cage?
You, I just came from downstairs. You were trapped in the cage, and Roberto is down there. You told me to come up here and wait, but you didn't say for what.
My God. I sit down on the desk. Oh, my God. Matt sits down in my chair and looks up at me. Look, I can explain, I begin.
You can?
Sure. I think about it. You see...
Oh, fuck.
It's something really weird, isn't it, Henry?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. We stare at each other. Look, Matt, let's go downstairs and see what's going on, and I'll explain to you and Roberto together, okay?
Okay.
We stand up and we go downstairs. As we walk down the east corridor, I see Roy loitering near the entrance to the stairs. He starts when he sees me, and just as he's about to ask me the obvious, I hear Catherine say, Hi, boys, what's up? As she breezes past us and tries to open the door to the stairs. Hey, Roy, how come no can open?
Well, Miss Meade, Roy glances at me. We've been having a problem with,
It's okay, Roy, I say. Come on, Catherine. Roy, would you mind staying up here? He nods and lets us into the stairwell. As we step inside, I hear Roberto say,
Listen, I do not appreciate you sitting in there telling me science fiction. If I wanted science fiction, I would borrow some from Amelia.
He's sitting on the bottom stairs, and as we come down behind him, he turns to see who it is. Hi, Roberto, I say softly. Catherine says, Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Roberto stands up and loses his balance, and Matt reaches over and steadies him. I look over at the cage, and there I am. I'm sitting on the floor, wearing my white shirt and khakis, and hugging my knees to my chest, obviously freezing and hungry. There's a cup of coffee sitting outside the cage. Roberto and Matt and Catherine watch us silently. When are you from? I ask. August 2006. I pick up the coffee, hold it at chin level, poke the straw through the side of the cage. He sucks it down. You want this sweet roll? He does. I break it into three parts and push it in. I feel like I'm at the zoo. You're hurt, I say. I hit my head on something, he says. How much longer are you going to be here? Another half hour or so. He gestures to Roberto. You see? What is going on? Catherine asks. I consult myself. You want to explain? I'm tired. Go ahead. So, I explain. I explain about being a time traveler, the practical and genetic aspects of it. I explain about the whole thing is really a sort of disease and I can't control it. I explain about Kendrick and about how Claire and I met and met again. I explain about causal loops and quantum mechanics and photons and the speed of light. I explain about how it feels to be living outside of the time constraints most humans are subject to. I explain about the lying and the stealing and the fear. I explain about trying to have a normal life. And part of having a normal life is having a normal job, I conclude. Well, I wouldn't really call this a normal job, Catherine says. I wouldn't call this a normal life, says myself, sitting inside the cage. I look at Roberto, who is sitting on the stairs, leaning his head against the wall. He looks exhausted and wistful. So, I ask him, are you going to fire me? Roberto sighs. No. No, Henry, I'm not going to fire you. He stands up carefully and brushes off the back of his coat with his hand. But I don't understand why you didn't tell me all this a long time ago. You wouldn't have believed me, says myself. You didn't believe me just now until you saw. Well, yes, Roberto begins, but his next words are lost in the odd noise vacuum that sometimes accompanies my comings and goings. I turn and see a pile of clothes lying on the floor of the cage. I will come back later this afternoon and fish them out with a clothes hanger. I turn back to Matt, Roberto, and Catherine. They look stunned.
Gosh, says Catherine. It's like working with Clark Kent.
I feel like Jimmy Olsen, says Matt.
Ugh.
Well, that makes you Lois Lane, Roberto teases Catherine.
No, Claire is Lois Lane, she replies.
Matt says, but Lois Lane was oblivious to the Clark Kent Superman connection, whereas Claire... Without Claire, I would have given up a long time ago, I say. I never understood why Clark Kent was so hell-bent on keeping Lois Lane in the dark.
It makes a better story, says Matt.
Does it? I don't know, I reply. Friday, July 7th, 2006. Henry is 43. I'm sitting in Kendrick's office, listening to him explain why it's not going to work. Outside, the heat is stifling, blazing, hot, wet wool mummification. In here, it's air-conditioned enough that I'm hunched goose flesh in this chair. We're sitting across from each other in the same chairs we always sit in. On the table is an ashtray full of cigarette filters. Kendrick has been lighting each cigarette off the end of the previous one.
We're sitting with the lights off, and the air is heavy with smoke and cold. I want a drink. I want to scream. I want Kendrick to stop talking so I can ask him a question. I want to stand up and walk out, but I sit listening. When Kendrick stops talking, the background noises of the building are suddenly apparent. Henry, did you hear me? I sit up and look at him like a schoolchild caught daydreaming. No. I asked you if you understood why it won't work. Yeah. I try to pull my head together. It won't work because my immune system is all fucked up, and because I'm old, and because there are too many genes involved.
Right.
Kendrick sighs and stubs out his cigarette in the mound of stubs. Tendrils of smoke escape and die.
I'm sorry.
He leans back in his chair and clasps his soft pink hands together in his lap. I think about the first time I saw him, here in this office 8 years ago. Both of us were younger and cockier, confident in the bounty of molecular genetics, ready to use science to confound nature. I think about holding Kendrick's time-traveling mouse in my hands, about the surge of hope.